we return. It is today's Topical Currents, Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman on this Tuesday edition. Well, this hour we discuss a topic which is anathema to most Americans. That would be quitting. Those of us who were raised by Depression-era parents certainly learned to disdain ever throwing in the towel. Joining us now is psychotherapist and consultant Alan Bernstein. He's the co-author of Mastering the Art of Quitting, Why It Matters in Life, Love, and Work. And he joins us from New York City. Welcome to you, Alan Bernstein.
Well, thank you so much, Richard.
Well, this is Job.
Oh, this is Job.
Whatever.
Hello. Hi. Well, quitting usually conjures up such negative associations, excepting, of course, bad habits. But what it looked to me like is today we're really going to be speaking about transitioning or letting go rather than just quitting. Would you agree?
I would. We're talking about acknowledging how irrational the issue of quitting really is. Most people, they imagine that they're working from objective circumstances, but really they're controlled by impulses that they may have very little consciousness of. And I can cite a few for you.
Okay.
One of them, you know, you're probably familiar with. I remember intimate reinforcement from Dr. Skinner at Harvard from many years ago, where he had three groups of rats. And one group of rat, every time they hit a lever, a pellet came out and fed them. And they were very happy rats. The second group was rats who hit the lever, and when they did, no food came out, and these rats went about their rat business, you know, running in their little wheel and hiding in their sawdust. But the third group, these rats, sometimes when they hit the lever, a pellet came out, and sometimes it didn't. And in the videos that you see from the period, these rats are clearly the most anxious. And they are sleeping around the lever with one little paw on the lever. Because what they're getting is just enough reinforcement to keep them hooked in. And that happens to many of us when we try to make a transition or quit something. We tend to see it as, you know, we're so close, it may actually happen, when in fact we're no closer than we could have been, and it's really just a kind of wishful thinking or an optimistic bias, as we call it in psychology, that keeps us hooked into trying it out.
You talk about quitting positive. Mm-hmm. What does that mean?
Well, what that means is that when we encourage people to, and I won't use the term quit because I think it's too loaded, when we encourage people to disengage from where they've been, we've noted that it takes a number of different levels in order to do that successfully. And the first one is the cognitive, what we call cognitive. You have to make an intellectual decision that what you're doing really isn't working. And for most people, that alone is very hard. The second thing that you have to do is make a decision that you're going to quit emotionally, which is also very loaded. I mean, who among us doesn't know the divorce friend who can't stop talking about his ex-husband or ex-wife, or the guy who got fired who can't stop talking about how lousy his boss was and how he got screwed? And until we disengage emotionally, we really don't have the ability to move forward with any kind of new energy, new emphasis. Thirdly, we have to disengage our motivation. In other words, we have to actually switch from something that has motivated us in the past, whether it was a relationship or a career, and find something going forward that has an equal ability to give us that sense of triumph and oomph that's going to move us forward. And finally, once we do make the decision on those three levels, then we have to change our behavior to go in that direction. And there are two levels to that, two sub-levels. I hope I'm not getting over technical here. But the first one is what we call deliberative, meaning that you have to scan the landscape for something that truly appeals to you, something that appeals to you intrinsically, that enhances your sense of yourself. And once you find that, you give up the deliberative mindset, which is the scanning mindset, and you go into what we call the implemental mindset, which is putting yourself with full energy to go into the future. That's a lot of thought. That's a lot of what we call artistry in acknowledging the uselessness of something that's been useful to you in the past but no longer serves that purpose, and now you have to find a new target going into the future.
How about people who are so wrapped up in their jobs that their career, that is them, it's their main being?
Yeah.
Say,
well,
you know, I'm a stockbroker, I'm a doctor, and there's a fear of like just losing yourself when you retire.
Well, that's true. I mean, the last book I did was on called Your Retirement Your Way, which explores just that option. When people are so identified with their career title, when they give it up, there's frequently a period of real sense of loss and sorrow, and even for some people, something close to a clinical depression. I actually did a study a few years ago of CEOs who retired, and a very high percentage, something over 40%, were dead within 3 years of retiring, much higher than you'd expect.
Mm. I guess, go ahead, I'm sorry.
Yeah, well, what I want to emphasize, though, from the first question, it's such a great question, is that persistence is hardwired into us, and that the issues which keep us there are largely unknown to us. I mean, the one I cited was intermittent reinforcement, but there are a number of others. Most of us have what's known as the sunk cost fallacy built into us, and what that is means, you know, we put so much time, effort, and money into something, we can't bear to let go of it, and it can be something very, large and, overriding, like a career. But it can also be something very small. I just had it. My wife and I have a 8-year-old Honda, and the engine light came on last week, and we brought it into the dealer, and he said, "Oh my, that's a $2,000 fix." And we were stuck right there in the sunk cost fallacy. Were we putting $2,000 into a losing proposition, or were we, in fact, making our car whole again for another 10 years?
And what'd you decide?
I decided to put the money into it, but I knew at that moment that I had no way of predicting whether, in fact, this was money well spent or, just throwing money at a problem that's going to disappear. But that when it comes to career, you can imagine how paralyzing that can be for people. I have spent so much time, effort, money to become a lawyer. How can I legitimately give that future up?
Mm-hmm. I'm thinking also about people who suffer from separation anxiety that makes them it makes it unbearable to leave anything. Mm-hmm. They can't let go. So,
yeah, well, we do have a number of exercises in our book, Mastering the Art of Quitting, which helps people define their separation styles. I think it's very important. But the fact that you have difficulty separating does not mean that you can't. It means that you may have to be much more attuned to the actual steps you're going to have to go through than someone who finds it easier to do that. And a lot of that's frankly based on our initial upbringing. People who are what they call well-attached, they have a sense of emotional satisfaction in their parenting, find it much easier to move on to the next phase than people who are attached in a way that's ambivalent or problematic. For them, it's very, very threatening to try a new situation. But not hopeless, just difficult.
So what kind of tools would someone like that need to develop, the latter?
Well, what we spend a fair amount of time on in the book is differentiating between what we call intrinsic versus extrinsic values and things. By extrinsic, it's pretty obvious in our society what we mean: career title, where you live, what kind of car you drive, how successful you imagine yourself to be and present yourself as. Whereas intrinsic is meeting some inner sense of who you should be. What motivates you, how much you can define yourself in terms of your satisfaction. It was a very, very good book written about 20 years ago by Dr. Checha Mihai, quite a mouthful of a name, at the University of Chicago. The book was called Flow, and he helped people define when they were meeting their motivational needs. He gave them a rather simple thing to work from, an idea to work from, that is, try to think of things in your life where you were challenged to accomplish something you didn't know if you could, and in trying to meet that challenge, you lost all track of time. And in that particular scenario, you basically were doing everything that interested you, doing it in the style in which you were interested, and finally you were meeting your motivational sweet spot. You were doing whatever it was that motivates you to your highest level of achievement. And so we use the concept of intrinsic versus extrinsic reward as a way of helping people decide how close their current situation is to meeting their intrinsic needs. And those are obviously much deeper and more valuable than the extrinsic ones.
We're speaking with Alan Bernstein. He's a psychotherapist, consultant, and author. He's the co-author with Peg Streep of Mastering the Art of Quitting, Why It Matters in Life, Love, and Work. On today's Topical Currents, we're going to take a short break, and we'll come back and take your calls.
A little upbeat version of our musical theme. It's today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and also psychotherapist and consultant Alan Bernstein. We're talking about his book, Mastering the Art of Quitting.
If you'd like to come forward with your tales of quitting, whether in life, love, or work, or whether you're a person who finds it very, very difficult to let go, and whether the quitting worked for you, all those kind of things, call us at 1-800-743-9576. 1-800-743-9576, or you can email radio@wlrn.org.
Alan Bernstein, in the book you speak of American exceptionalism. Are we really more hard-headed than other countries' residents are?
Well, I'm not sure that we're more hard-headed, but I think we're more given to persistence than other cultures. I think our country was founded on persistence. Can you imagine being part of a covered wagon party that's heading out west, not knowing, you know, where you're going or what to expect out there? And you can imagine the early Puritans arriving, the Pilgrims, to a country again that was unknown. So I think, very much culturally speaking, we tend to value persistence as a cultural norm. And, you know, I'm not against persistence, by the way. I hope it's not sounding that way. What I'm arguing for is quitting as an equal opportunity to staying the course. There are people who just do not allow themselves that thought because quitting has such a pejorative tone in our society. I mean, it's almost synonymous with loser. And yeah.
How do we know for certain that it's time to move on? I mean, I'm thinking sometimes, for example, in a relationship,
mm-hmm.
Where it just takes more compromise or it takes mm-hmm. more work. Relationships mm-hmm. are difficult, you always mm-hmm. hear. So mm-hmm. how do you know when it's time? How do you know when it's time to stay, to move on, to mm-hmm. be quiet, mm-hmm. to step back? How do you know?
Isn't that a wonderful question? Now, if I had the answer to that question, Bonnie.
Yes.
No, I mean, there is no such thing as certitude around this. What you can look for is, you know, how much you're being controlled by what we call the intermittent reinforcement fallacy that we talked about, you know, with the rats before.
Mm-hmm.
Are you staying because every once in a while things go your way and it gives you hope that the relationship can actually change, that she will actually understand your needs and meet them? Or are you, in fact, you know, in a hopeless situation where it's never going to happen? This is some interesting data. They did some brain studies. This will interest you guys. They did some brain studies of people playing the slots. And what they found, you're all familiar with slots, whether you have those three windows that come up with three cherries or raspberry.
Right.
So when they found that, for example, when people were looking at the slots and the two of them were matching cherries and the middle one was almost the cherries, people's amygdala lit up. The amygdala is the front part of the brain. it's as if they were almost winning, when in fact they were no closer to winning than they would have been if they had had two cherries and a raspberry. But the people got excited as if they had more of an opportunity to win. And unfortunately, sometimes that segues over to our relationships, where we imagine if we get some of what we want, or enough of what we want, it promises that the future is going to be, you know, brighter and more successful than we actually have any reason to believe. And, you know, we can persist in that.
You know, preparing for this program, it made me reflect a little bit, and I was thinking about the actors McLean Stevenson and Gary Berghoff. Here they were with major parts with what was then the most popular television show in history. They decided to move forward, and their careers went down the tubes.
Mm. Well, what's happened to a number of actors who just decided that the roles they're playing, there was a fellow in the original version of NYPD Blues who left after two seasons hoping he could parlay his newfound success into Hollywood, and he didn't. So,
some people, I'm thinking, make their choice by doing nothing, so that the choice can be made for them.
Well, that's what's known as a passive choice. It's not choosing. It's choosing passively rather than actively. There's a lot of interesting data on that.
Like what?
Well, that initially people, for example, who make the choice to do something actively, let's say they're two stocks that you are thinking of, one you hold and one you're thinking of buying, and then if you buy it and it doesn't work out, you initially, you know, can go through a period of hardship, but that over long term, people actually regret more their passive behavior than their active behavior. So it's a kind of complex research that's been done on it. There are two different stages of regret there. And the short term may favor passive behavior, but the long term favors active behavior.
Okay.
Let's take a telephone call or two. We're talking about quitting. If you'd like to call in with your experience of quitting and whether you were glad or later had regrets. First up, it's Susan in Davie. Hi there.
Hi. I had the experience twice in my lifetime of having job situations where both times it was a job I enjoyed or whatever, but still it became intolerable because of, you know, them demanding too much. And in one case, I had a very bad boss. I mean, he was a very nice man, but completely incompetent. And at a certain point, I just kept banging my head against the wall, trying to get them to change, doing all this stuff. And then you finally do the thing where you're like, if you don't do this, I'm going to quit. And they ignore you because they think you're not going to. And then I quit. And in both these cases, I never felt one ounce of regret, even though it was a financial hardship at the time. You know, my husband and I lost, you know, a significant income, and I didn't have a job to replace it at the time. But I, not for one second did I regret the quitting in both of those cases, because and as soon as I did, I thought to myself, I should have quit years ago.
Hmm. Alan?
Yeah. Well, that's a kind of enough is enough story in both cases. I mean, what I've seen is that people who can't do what you do actually not only suffer emotionally, but many of them suffer physically. If they go on long enough in an impossible situation with a conflicting you know, desire like that, where they both want the money but also hate the experience of working for a boss who's incompetent.
Yeah, and the thing that was kind of funny, too, was after I did quit, especially with the incompetent boss, then they were like, oh, no, what can we do to make this better? And I was like, no, I'm done. Mm-hmm. You know, because I knew it would just be a matter of time before the same thing happened again.
Well, you were prescient. You were looking forward to what was likely to come out of it. But sometimes, actually, people in those situations, they have a lot of leverage. And, you know, sometimes they can, you know, remake the opportunity. But, you knew the landscape, of course, better than I did.
Yeah. Well, anyway, I just wanted to say that, if somebody's in that situation, sometimes you can think, like, oh, I can't quit because we need, you know. And it was definitely a hardship. Mm-hmm. You know, we went from having a very comfortable life to being in a situation where every penny counted and, you know, always worried, oh, my God, what if my husband loses his job? But, you know, in the end, it was great. So, anyway, I'm glad you guys are doing this program.
Yeah, but it also sounds like you had a very supportive spouse there.
Oh yeah, definitely, definitely. He's a great guy. Still yeah. a great guy, and you know it made him just work harder. And
yeah.
But we had great dinners after that too.
Yeah, but I was thinking that, Susan. What do you tell somebody who's in your situation, and doesn't have a spouse, and needs the income?
Yeah, that would be, you know, I don't know. I know that I had said over and over again, I can't keep working like this. You guys, please do this, please do that. You know, because I didn't want to be that person who's threatening to quit all the time. Because, you know, I mean, there are people that do that. If you don't do this, I'm going to quit. And then they never quit.
Yeah.
I never threatened to quit. But when I finally did say I'm quitting, I was done because I just had the feeling that. But for somebody who, I don't know, maybe start really looking while you're still employed, really looking for something else, even if you have to take somewhat of a pay cut, the reward in your psyche and lack, you know, the sleepless nights and the constant, you know, toward the end of that job, I put on so much weight. Because all I did would be, you know, come home and eat a bowl of mashed potatoes.
Comfort food.
Yeah, because I was so miserable.
Mm.
And it wasn't the work. You know, I didn't have a job that I hated. The job itself was a good job. Mm-hmm. It was just, you know, incompetence and, you know, I don't know.
I suppose medical benefits would also keep people in
exactly.
jobs that they'd like to leave.
That's the other thing. We did have insurance.
Yeah.
So if my insurance had been the sole insurance, I would not have been able to quit that job. So
let's for a moment speculate about people who don't have the advantage of a spouse.
Thank you, Susan.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Who don't have a supportive spouse or a spouse at all and are really worried about health insurance.
Mm-hmm.
If they're in Susan's situation, they may want to try and negotiate earlier. You know, it sounds like she waited until she was really fed up to quit, but, you know, you may want to see what you can do in terms of negotiation at an earlier point and see whether or not it's successful and before you've had it up to here, to the point where you're actually doing physical harm to yourself and hurting yourself. I mean, there are a lot of people who suffer, you know, first mentally and emotionally, but finally physically from the stress of feeling that they're in a situation that they hate, but that they cannot leave. And I haven't been there myself. It's a terrible place. Interestingly, Peg and I came to this book because we had the same background. We both were in the middle of a PhD dissertation in English literature, of all things, and both of us decided that it wasn't the right career for us. And having invested at that point 3.5 or 4 years in our educations, we had parallel experiences, and we both left the experience at a critical moment. So, I mean, for me, it's seared into my mind forever how powerful the experience of making a decision of this magnitude is. I mean, you have to, you know, as a lot, we're a conservative lot, humans, in terms of actually taking loss, staring it right in the face, you know. I mean, oh, my God, I've wasted 4 years. Oh, my God, I sold that stock, and I lost money on it. We hate the experience of actually having to acknowledge and face our losses.
It's about time for a break. We're speaking with Alan Bernstein. He's a psychotherapist and consultant and the co-author of Mastering the Art of Quitting, Why It Matters in Life, Love, and Work. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to Tuesday's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and we're visiting with Alan Bernstein. He's a psychotherapist, consultant, and author. And this book is entitled The Art of Quitting, Mastering the Art of Quitting, Why It Matters in Life, Love, and Work. And we'd like to continue to take your calls. We do have some lines open, 1-800-743-9576. 1-800-743-9576, or you can email radio@wlrn.org.
And we will go back to some calls. This is Anna. She's in Miami Beach. Thanks for your patience for waiting. Hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Could you speak up a little bit?
Hi, sorry. Thank you for taking my call. So I have a question. It's not a personal question. It's regarding my mother-in-law, actually, who has a somewhat volatile relationship with her daughter. And as a daughter-in-law, it's very difficult to step in and, you know, try to give advice on the matter. But basically, it's a long and complicated story, but to sum it up, my sister-in-law has lots of mental health issues, you know, from bipolar to borderline personality disorder. And my husband and other family members on their side seem to think that a lot of it was caused from my mother-in-law's constant need to, you know, spoil, rescue, never allow her to kind of grow up and leave that child phase. She's now in her 30s and still has a relationship with, where she depends very, very highly on my mother-in-law. And I think everyone in the family has tried countless times to kind of intervene and tell her, you know, you need to step back from this relationship. You need to, you know, allow your daughter to, you know, grow up and be an independent daughter. And I guess my question is, how, you know, should I be dealing with it? You know, it's hard for me to see a lot of these things, to see, you know, someone who's capable and smart, but never been given the opportunities to grow as a person.
So whether you become more involved or whether you just quit dealing with it?
Right.
What do you think, Alan?
And my husband, who's also very much emotionally involved in it, and I don't know how to support him, really, going through this.
Hmm. Well, is there an opportunity to, I'm not clear whether your mother-in-law actually would experience you addressing this with her as an opportunity or an attack. You know, if it's an opportunity, you could, you know, work with her on imagining other ways to treat her daughter. But if she's extremely touchy about any kind of interference in the family system, you may end up, you know, stirring the coals. It's really a judgment call. What do you think? Is she accessible in this particular way?
Right. In the past, my husband and I have tried, and usually she breaks down emotionally, and then it's hard for us to continue because you know, you don't want someone to, you know, start crying and bawling. And I think she feels a lot of guilt for what has happened, but she doesn't want to take ownership that she maybe has had an impact on her daughter's life and
I would prepare her then for the discussion, say, you know, would you be open to a discussion about how we might better handle whatever your sister-in-law's name is, because clearly it's not working out for the best for anybody. And if she agrees to that discussion, I would go ahead with it. But if she doesn't agree to it, you know, the chances are that you're just going to be making your relationship and your husband's with her much more difficult and problematic. So I would spend a lot of time doing the prep work for the discussion. You know, I'd really like to talk to you about something that's very important to me. Would you be willing to consider this? It's not about what you've done wrong. It's about how we can move forward and, you know, engage her at that level so it becomes an objective discussion rather than a judgment of her, which is going to be very dangerous.
Right.
Okay, Anna, good luck.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Okay. Thanks for your call.
Again, if you want to join in our conversation about quitting, has it been a good experience? Are you having difficulty quitting or transitioning, as we're calling it today? Call us at 1-800-743-9576. 1-800-743-9576.
Or if you're a little shy, you can email Bonnie. That's radio@wlrn.org.
I was thinking that sometimes you say that quitting is a healthy adaptive response when a goal can't be reached, but then you have to know what your goal is. Because I'm thinking about someone who's at a job and they love it, but they're just not getting ahead. How do they know when it's time to move on? What if their goal is unrealistic? What if they say, you know, I want to be a manager here, or maybe it's realistic, I don't know. But
that's where the cognitive assessment comes in. They have to really make an assessment of whether what they want is possible in the place that they're at, and that may involve asking people in the organization. It may involve their own assessment of it. What we're addressing here is people who don't take that step. In other words, they imagine themselves becoming managers but don't do a really hard assessment of whether it's possible or not. And if you find that, you know, if you do X and Y, it takes certain steps, if you're advised by people that it'll strengthen your position, that's great. But if other people tell you, really, it's very unlikely it's going to happen here, you're probably better off looking somewhere else to do it. And, you know, what we advocate in the book is once you make the decision to move ahead, whichever direction you're going in, you have to also do what we call mental contrasting, which is measuring what the likelihood of success if you do plan A versus plan B is. What's going to happen if I... And don't fall into, you know, what's called in the psychology business an optimistic bias. In other words, imagining because you want it, it's going to work out.
Mm-hmm.
We encourage you to actually do a what-if scenario. If A, then B. Supposing B doesn't work, then what's your plan C and what's your plan D? And to the best of your ability, trying to figure out what the options are going to be going forward rather than, you know, daydreaming about how successful you're going to be.
Right.
One of the interesting dynamics that we've studied is the how to present to yourself what the options are. That if you start with an I will option, meaning that you give yourself a win-lose situation, I will be a manager, I will do this, that it doesn't seem to work as well for people than if they formulate it as will I. In other words, if you set it forward as a interrogative, as a question, as a supposition, that seems to, the option for a challenge seems for somehow to be more engaging for people than the directive, the win-lose, black-white, you know, I either did it or I failed. Will I seems to bring out a much more dynamic element in people.
Yeah, that could work.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Let's take another caller. This is Pembroke Pines listener. Hi.
Yes, hi. How are you?
Hello.
Hi.
Hi, hi.
Hi. I'm not high. I'm high. I like to use the word detachment a lot in situations like that. And it's a matter, as far as I'm concerned, of how much you take other people personally, situations personally. Ego is opposed to self-esteem. I find that people that can't let go are usually holding on through a sense of resentment, which ties to, you know, when you spoke about the slot machines,
mm-hmm.
Part of that psychology is the more they can upset you, the more you'll play, the harder you'll try to win. And I find that a lot of times people are in situations that they can't let go because they can't admit or they feel that they're going to, that it's a loss and not a win, and that mm-hmm. the other person is going to win or the whatever it is. I think that in order for a person to really be able to move away from a situation, that they have to have a decent level of self-esteem. In other words, self-evaluation. And not necessarily what other people think of you, which is the ego. And so your decisions are basically on what other people will think or how other people will react to your quitting rather than what you need for yourself.
Well, we sort of discussed that a little bit when we talked about extrinsic versus intrinsic value, that if you're dominated by what people think of you, as you say, you tend to operate from an external view of yourself rather than, you know, a kind of felt internal experience.
Right, and the ability to validate yourself
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So that you can move away comfortably, indifferently.
Well, research supports what you're saying.
Rather than walking away in anger, the only way that you can walk away successfully is indifferently.
Mm-hmm. Indifferently or with the sense
indifferently. In other words, not to have any attachment. The stronger attachment than love is resentment. Mm-hmm. I think people stay together more out of a sense of fear and anger than out of love.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's an old Chinese quotation, if you love somebody and they don't love you, examine your own love.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Okay, hi.
Okay, thank you, hi.
You're welcome.
We'll ponder that one. Thank you.
I'd like to hear it in Chinese, actually.
What do you mean when you say reset our inner compass?
Well, in other words, if we have one idea about what our future consists of, in other words, we have this kind of inner picture of our future, and it's not, in fact, working out that way. This goes back to what I talked about, Peg and I leaving our dissertations. You may have to reset it. I had to actually consider going back to school, which at that point you can imagine I was really sick of. But, you know, given that I was about to give up a whole career, I really had to be very, very powerfully reset to go in a new direction, to go back to school, to go through all the internal struggles, the sense of remotivating myself in a new direction. That's very powerful. And as I said, it works on those four levels. You have to make your mind up, the cognitive level. You have to acknowledge the fact you're going to feel lousy, the emotional level. You're going to feel angry and blame people. And then finally, you're going to feel really sad before you reestablish a direction forward. And then you have to remotivate yourself in the direction you want to go, and you have to commit yourself to being successful in that new direction. Mm. There's a lot of stuff there.
A lot of steps. We're speaking with Alan Bernstein, psychotherapist, consultant, author of the Mastering the Art of Quitting, Why It Matters in Life, Love, and Work. A short break, and we'll come back and take more of your calls. Stay with us.
And it is today's Topical Currents, our final segment. Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman.
But we're not quitting.
We're never giving up.
I'm glad to hear that.
We're never giving up.
Right.
Let's go to Penelope. Excuse me. She's in Fort Lauderdale. Hi.
Hello.
Hello.
Good afternoon.
Hi, you're on.
Hi. Oh, you can hear me great. I'm on this cell. I just needed to thank you for the opportunity to acknowledge the author. This is just a brief comment in reference to all and everything that he has said. It definitely identifies with your mental attitude and cognitive. Now that I'm retired, early retirement here in Florida, I've had time to reassess, as he has said, and look into my life and to see why so many of the teaching venues that I was in, from New York to Indiana to D.C. to Florida, were so short-lived. And the quitting, your book just hits the point on target. And I'm looking at why I left certain arenas because, and it never did, I didn't have the anger, as you had mentioned, or I didn't lose any sleep or anything. But it was because I wanted to reach the students, and there were always the negative, the other colleagues who were, what is the word, jealous, or there was sabotage at different places, but the students I was able to reach. So I quit. Now, didn't quit teaching, but quit that particular school or that particular system and tried to reach the young people in a different arena. So when you are self-preserved within yourself and you are clear of who you are and what you want to do, quitting does not become that phenomena. You don't lose any sleep, even though, as the young lady had said there before, what did she say, when you lose your job, sometimes you have to have a different lifestyle, and if you don't have a spouse, then you have to rearrange your life, as you had mentioned, and reconstruct, he had said. So I was single before I was married, and then I'm divorced.
I think most people are.
Yes.
But in that, in those different marital or living lifestyles, my quitting, as he had mentioned, auto quitting, never stopped. And my spouse at that time understood me, even though that income may have been a viable source. But he understood why I didn't remain. But I'm thinking of now, with you as a psychologist, was it because I was an only child? I'm trying to assess this. As an only child, my parents allowed me to think on my own. And I didn't quit in school. I always excelled in school. But I was more or less bullied because of that, you know, being excellent or whatever. But it didn't bother me. It never bothered me. So do you think it's because, being an only child, you are a little bit stronger in those kind of lifestyles?
Does that translate to Alan?
Well, it sounds like you've been able to, in all these situations, find a way through, and, you know, based on your own mental fortitude and strength. So I wouldn't definitively say it's because you're an only child. It certainly doesn't sound like it hurt. And what sounds more clear is how capable you were of making decisions for yourself, finding the parts of your career, that is, the work with the children directly, really spoke to you and worked for you, whereas the work with some of the administration and your peers didn't. So you found a way to renegotiate your job and make it work, which is terrific. I love when people do that.
Oh, thanks so much for calling. We have an emailer who says he or she finds it difficult to function in the workplace when one is the only Black individual in the office, and the others want you to be subservient to them, even if you know more than they do. Could you address this? Do we keep on or do we quit?
Wow. I would first, explore whether the situation, you know, has any remediation there. You may want to talk to your immediate superior. You may want to make a decision whether that's truly, truly happening the way you see it. I mean, it's one of those things that is subtle. But if it's there and it's built into the office culture, I would not be a very happy camper. It doesn't sound like you are. And I might look for a place that is less bigoted.
So in this case, it might be advisable to quit.
I mean, you probably would want to spend a little bit of time making sure that your experience is exactly what's going on, that you're not, you know, filtering it through your own anxieties, but that's hard to do. You'd have to have a really trusted superior or advisor there to do that.
We're getting very short on time. I ask our callers to be brief. Linda in Coral Springs. Hi there.
Hi, this is Linda. Did you call on me?
This is Linda.
Yes, hi. Yes, I was calling because I wanted to confirm something that the doctor said about when you end up quitting and end up with major depression.
Mm-hmm.
But what happened is I was with a company for about 31 years.
Mm-hmm.
I was in a pretty high-powered sales position, and near the end I was not happy at all, but I couldn't quit because my husband needed the benefits.
Mm-hmm.
And so I ended up getting early retirement. At first, I was just completely thrilled.
Mm-hmm.
But almost immediately after that, I ended up in being diagnosed with major depression.
Mm.
So, sometimes when you get what you want, you don't always get what you want.
Right.
Well, it doesn't come in a complete package. I'm sorry to hear about that. Major depression is nothing to laugh about. It really is a powerful negative experience. You made a decision that seemed right at the time. Obviously, there was a part of you that really wasn't comfortable with the decision you made. And, you know, it doesn't mean can't be unmade. You know, you can rethink it at this point. And there are some great therapies and, you know, very sophisticated medications that may be able to help you through the depression at this point and prepare you for the second act of your career. But I think you did what you felt you had to do at the time. And it's hard to predict what the outcome of that's going to be.
Right. I think that people really do identify with what they do for a living.
They do. Some people more than others. And usually what we try to get people to do in those situations is to identify the meta meaning of what they do. In other words, if you're married and you get divorced, and what you find is that you really miss intimate connections with others, you can, you know, enter into a church group or a community group where the stimulus really is the emotional energy of being around other people in a very involved way. If you're very high-powered in your career and you lose it for some reason, you may find ways to meet those needs of leadership in volunteer organizations. So in other words, we recommend thinking about what it is that's motivating the experience you had and seeing if you can define it in some other way in the community.
Right.
Okay, thanks for your call.
Thank you, Linda.
Okay, bye-bye.
Well, Alan Bernstein, yeah. Yes, is a psychotherapist, consultant, teacher. You've done teaching, and he's an author. Mm-hmm. And he's the co-author with Peg Streep of Mastering the Art of Quitting, Why It Matters in Life, Love, and Work. And we'll have a link on our website and our Facebook page to your book. And we want to thank you very much for being with us today.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
Okay.
Topical Currents is produced by Richard Ives, technical direction from online producer Paul Leary. We have free audio archives and downloads at our website, wlrn.org. More information, including books and author links, at the Topical Currents Facebook page. Tomorrow's program is our popular At Your Service call-in program on pets, with veterinarian Ian Kupke and canine behavior specialist Adele Mietas. How best to acclimate a new puppy or kitten to your home? Bonnie needs to know. To the calendar on this day in 1913, 101 years ago, the birth of actor and voiceover whiz Jim Backus in Cleveland. He voiced Mr. Magoo and played Thurston Howell III on Gilligan's Island. What was Mr. Magoo's first name? Quincy. And on this day, 1928, 86 years ago, the birth of writer and producer Larry Gelbart in Chicago. He wrote for Danny Thomas on radio, Jack Parr, Sid Caesar, and of course, produced the TV version of MASH. He also played James Dean's father in Rebel Without a Cause. Jim Backus. And one more before we go falsetto. On this day in 1978, 35 years ago, the top three songs on the U.S. charts are all by the Bee Gees. Staying Alive, How Deep Is Your Love, and Night Fever. The number 4 and 5 songs were also written by the Brothers Gibb. The theme music created by Michael Levine. So we leave with a definition from Jim Backus. Backus's definition: mistress, something between a mister and a mattress. That wasn't too risque. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman. Stay tuned for Here and Now from NPR News.